Today I want to talk about Job. In the book of Job, most people talk about the suffering, but there's so many more secrets revealed there. I wanted to cover first, the first secrets that are revealed truly are insight into both God and into Satan. And then we actually have some of the first glimpses into the Messiah. Now, he refers to him as a redeemer. He doesn't call him the Messiah, but he's still talking about Jesus. And then I want to talk about the age within which Job, the book of Job, was written. Not when it was written, but the time frame as to where it fits into history. And lastly, I wanted to talk about some of the secrets of science that were revealed. Some of the questions that are asked are absolutely so profound, they're not accident. Now, they may be hidden a little bit because they're put in poetry. And so I think a lot of people discount, but the questions themselves are so profound. And some of them we still don't know how to answer. And some of them it took us 3,400 years to answer. So back to the beginning Job chapter 1, I wanted to start in verse 6, and it says, "Now there was a day when the sons of God came to present themselves before the Lord, and Satan also came among them. The Lord said to Satan, 'From where do you come?' And Satan answered the Lord and said, 'From roaming to and from, roaming about on the earth and walking around on it.' And the Lord said to Satan, 'Have you considered my servant Job? For there is no one like him on the earth, a blameless, upright man, fearing God, turning from evil.' Then Satan answered the Lord, 'Does Job fear the Lord? Does Job fear God for nothing? You have made a hedge about him and his house and all that he has on every side. You have blessed the work of his hands, and his possessions have increased in the land. Put forth your hand now and touch all that he has. He will surely curse you and to your face.' Then the Lord said to Satan, 'Behold, all that he has is in your power. Only do not put forth your hand on him.' So Satan departed from the presence of the Lord." Now the point here is it was not Satan that came and challenged God. God challenged Satan. And the other thing that we see is that at this point, Satan still has access to heaven. So let's go on and look about some of the powers that Satan does have, and in some ways, restrictions, because God very definitely limited what Satan was able to do. He just doesn't have free reign, and he's got very much power. So, picking back up in verse 13, we see, "Now on the day when the sons and his daughters were eating and drinking wine on the old in their oldest brother's house, a messenger came to Job and said, 'The oxen were plowing and the donkeys were feeding beside them. And the Sabaeans attacked them and took them and slew the servants with the edge of the sword. And I alone escaped to tell you.' While he was still speaking, another also came and said, 'Fire of God fell from heaven and burned up all the sheep and the servants and consume them. I alone have escaped to tell you.' While he was speaking, another came and said, 'The Chaldeans formed three bands, made a rain on the camels and took them and slew the servants with the edge of the sword. And I alone escaped to tell you.' While he was still speaking, another came and said, 'Your sons and your daughters were eating and drinking wine at the oldest brother's house. And behold, a great wind came across the wilderness and struck the four corners of the house. and it fell on all the young, and they died. I alone escaped to tell you. Then Job arose and tore his robe and shaved his head and fell to the ground and worshiped. He said, "Naked I came from my mother's womb, naked I shall return there. The Lord gave, and the Lord has taken away. Blessed be the name of the Lord." Through all this, Job did not sin, nor did he blame God. Two things here. One, we can see the power that Satan has. He has power, obviously, over people or groups of people. He also has power over some of nature's forces in the wind. And he has the ability to kill, physically kill. Now, I find it interesting, and it's more of a question than a statement or that I haven't figured out. But at this point, why didn't he kill Job's wife? No. I don't mean that to be funny. I believe that the answer is truly in the Bible also, in that when God, in Genesis we see, they were to cleave, they were to be one. And if Job's wife and Job are one, Satan couldn't have touched her. And so, it's one of those things. Now, also, I think Satan is so evil, I don't think we give him enough credit for not only his craftiness, but just to the extent that he'll do go to cause pain and suffering. Of course, we know the next chapter of Job, he goes and puts sickness and illness on Job, unbearable sickness, and he doesn't touch the wife. Now, you talk about if my wife was sick or my children were sick, it would cause me great pain and suffering. And to have one suffering and one not, just you realize the pressure or whatever that Satan put on that family. And so, anyway, the point being is that Satan is extremely evil. We need to fear him. Now, we need to fear God more. But the point being is that in this case, we have a picture of heaven. We have a picture that God does limit. Now, at this point, we don't know why God challenged Satan or why he picked on Job. But what we're going to see next is that through this period, Job grows. I don't mean physically or whatever, but he gains more understanding and more. And so the next part is what I claim is he speaks of the Messiah. And I do want to make one other point here before I get too far. Keep in mind that back in Job in chapter 42, when all this story is done and now God is talking, in this case, to Eliphaz, actually, he says to Eliphaz, he says, and this is in verse 42, or chapter 42, verse 7. He says, "It came about after the Lord had spoken these words to Job, that the Lord said to Eliphaz the Temanite, 'My wrath is kindled against you, you and your two friends, because you have not spoken of me what is right, as my servant Job has.'" So when you read all of the poetry and the things that Job says, recognize that God is saying that Job spoke accurately of God. And Eliphaz and his two friends, Bildad and Zophar, did not. And if you ever want to do an interesting study, go back and try to figure out what it was that they said that was wrong. And look at the words that Job said, what was right. So now I want to pick up in Job 9, and I've outlined 27 to 35. "Though I say I have forgotten my complaint, I leave off my sad countenance and be cheerful. I am afraid of all my pains. I know that you will not acquit me. I am accounted wicked, when I should, why then should I toil in vain? If I should wash myself with snow and cleanse my hands with lye, yet you would plunge me into the pit, and my clothes would abhor me. For he is not a man as I am, that I may answer him. Now, of course, he's talking about God here. And he says that we may go together in court. Verse 33, he says, there is no umpire between us who may lay his hand upon us both. Let him remove his rod from me, and let not the dread of him terrify me. Then I would speak and do not fear him, but I am not like that in myself. So here we have, at this point in time, Job is claiming that there is no umpire. And of course, we have another term we call a mediator or whatever. So now we jump to Job 16, verse 19. And now, through some of this suffering, listen to what he says. Even now, behold, my witness is in heaven, and my advocate is on high. We jump then to Job 19, 23 to 27. Oh, that my words were written. Oh, that they were inscribed in a book, that with iron stylus and lead, that they were engraved in the rock forever. As for me, I know my Redeemer lives, and in the last, he will take his stand on earth. Even after my skin is destroyed, yet from my flesh, I see God. I shall see God, whom I myself shall behold, and whom my eyes will see, and not another. My heart faints within me. See the progression? He didn't even have an umpire. Now he knows about him. And now he's even claiming he knows his Redeemer lives. Okay. Jump to Job 23, 8 to 12. Behold, I go forward, but he is not there, and backward, and I cannot perceive him. When he acts on the left, I cannot behold him. He turns to the right, and I do not see him. But he knows the way I take. When he has tried me, I shall come forth as gold. My foot has held fast to his path. I have kept the way and not turned aside. I have not departed from the command on his lips. I have treasured the words of his mouth more than necessary food. Well, where else have we heard that? Okay. So here we have, in my mind, the introduction really to Jesus, to the Messiah, to the Redeemer. And here it is in the Old Testament. So now the third thing I said I wanted to talk about was, okay, when was, what in history, where do we have any kind of clue as to when this takes place? Because a lot of people say, well, we don't know because there's nothing ever mentioned. And yet, in Job 4:1, we have the introduction to one of the characters, and that's Eliphaz. Eliphaz the Temanite. And so I'm going to jump to Job 15, where Eliphaz the Temanite responded. And he's talking to Job, and he's basically taking Job to task for his, in Eliphaz's words, windy knowledge. And he challenges them to the words. I probably ought to just read it. 15:1-11. Eliphaz the Temanite responded, should a wise man answer with windy knowledge and fill himself with the east wind? Should he argue with useless talk or with words that are not profitable? Indeed, you do away with reverence and hinder mediation before God. For your guilt teaches your mouth, and you choose the language of the crafty. Your own mouth condemns you. I do not. And your own lips testify against you. Were you the first man born, or were you brought forth before the hills? Do you hear a secret counsel of God and limit the wisdom to yourself? What do you know that we do not know? And what do you understand that we do not? Both the gray hair and the age are among us, older than your father. Now that's the key verse to me. Do we know where else we hear about Eliphaz? It's in Genesis, Genesis 36. We find that Eliphaz was the firstborn of Esau. Now, you could say, okay, there's other Eliphazes. Are we sure that this is the same Eliphaz? Well, so then we go on to the next part of that, which is that he's known as Eliphaz the Temanite. Now, of course, Esau, we know, married, you know, a couple of wives. Of course, one of them is Ada, which is Eliphaz's mother. And they were from Canaan. And then he marries one of, Ishmael's daughters. So they go to the east. And of course, we know Job is from the east, land of Uz. But so we have Eliphaz's firstborn is Teman. And we go on further out because of time. I'm going to go on a little bit and just paraphrase some of this. But it was fairly common in that time for the main patriarch, in this case Eliphaz, to have his sons, and they would be the chiefs that would build surrounding areas. And so the fact that Eliphaz is known as a Temanite, where his firstborn was Teman, I think is no mere coincidence. I think that we can make the assumption that this takes place, and if Eliphaz is the one that he's talking about being older than Job's father, of course, that puts Eliphaz in the same time frame, if you will, as Reuben and the 12 sons, the tribes. Now, we know that Esau was married some 40 or 50 years before Jacob was, and so there's some age differences there. But we do know, if this is valid, and that this was taken at about a time, probably around 1700 B.C., in the time that would have coincided, Job would have coincided with Manasseh and Ephraim, Joseph's sons. Next thing is I made the statement that there was a number of profound statements in science that were made. And there's four of them I'd like to pick. There was lots of them. There was well over 100 questions asked throughout Job, either by some of the friends or challenging Job or by God himself. But the four that I pick are the size and foundation of the earth. We find that in Job 38:18. Dividing of light and the traveling of light. We also find that in chapter 38. The springs of the deep. We find that also in Job. Now this would have been God talking to Job, asking him questions. And then the weight of the water versus the air. And we find that in Job 28, verse 25. So, the verse that I quoted was Job 38:18. And the verse reads, "Do you have you understood the expanse of the earth. Tell me if you know this. Now, believe it or not, this is one of the earlier times that something was discovered. I mean, it was fairly accurately described in 250 B.C. The person that did this was Eratosthenes, and he calculated that the circumference of the earth was roughly 26,000 miles. So he was off about 1,100 miles, but for that time it was fairly accurate. And then we jump to from there to in the around 500 A.D., an Italian mathematician, figured the diameter of the earth within 67 miles of its perimeter. And then in 1048 A.D., a Peruvian mathematician figured it out to within 16.8 kilometers. And so that's 0.27% of the accuracy. But you're talking, 1,000 years later. Right, 1,000 years after Jesus is born. But we're talking that this question was asked 1,600 years prior to that. Okay. And then finally, we get the size of the earth in 1906 was calculated within 100 meters of what we accept as the dimension. So that was within 0.002%. But here again, that's in 1906. A little bit before my time, but not much. So the second secret that was revealed, or question actually, was in Job 38:19 and 38:24. And the question is this: where is the way of the dwelling of light and darkness? Where is its place? And 24, where is the way the light is divided? Okay? Now, the profound parts of this question are, we know now that light is a traveling wave. It's not, whereas darkness is the absence of light. So the question was accurately placed or put, where is darkness? Where is the place of darkness? Meaning that that's not moving. But light itself is moving. And so that question, there's more to that question than you just on first glance. And where is the way light is divided? Now, does anybody remember their history? Was there ever a guy, Isaac Newton? You hear of him? Now, he was the one, when you look at prisms and you see that light is actually divided into different colors. He did that in 1675, 3,400 years after the question was asked. So I think the point being is that you might take one question in a poetry or something like that and say, okay, that, they can ask that by question. But when you start looking at all these different questions that were asked, and they're profound questions, and, 3,400 years later, with all our science and everything else, we finally figure out the answer to it. Or we find out, oh, that wasn't a frivolous question. He was asking something he already knew the answer to. So, the next question is in Job 38, verse 16. Have you entered the springs of the deep, or walked in the recesses of the... Have you entered the springs of the sea? I apologize. Or walked in the recesses of the deep? Now, I found this one interesting because in researching this, I come to find out that we didn't discover the springs of the deep until the late 1970s. And at the same time frame, some of the things that we were doing was we were exploring Mars. We were actually learning more about the planet Mars than we were about our own planet Earth. That in 1977, we sent the Viking explorer to orbit the Mars. And so that we knew some things about Mars that we didn't know about our own planet. And it wasn't until late 1970s that we actually, in the there's a rift in the Pacific that is like 35,000 feet deep. And that's where we discovered these hot springs with the sulfur coming out them, and the water is over 200 degrees. And we find abundant life that's thriving off of that sulfur and not off of sunlight. So here again, 1977 is when we discovered that. So here we have a tremendous time gap, and all of a sudden you start to look at some of these questions that were asked, and you say, oh, they weren't accidental. Like I said, I'm only touching the ones we've finally been able to answer. You know, the one question that I didn't address in the size of the Earth is what's its anchor, its foundation. Now, we know we circle the sun, but the sun's part of the Milky Way. We don't know what the anchor of the Milky Way is, or all that we all see, everything is expanding. So we still can't answer the anchor question. So the last scientific question that I wanted to address was in Job 28, verse 25. And it says, when he imparted weight to the wind and meted out the waters by measure. Now, another historical person I think we're all well aware of is Galileo. Anybody ever hear of him? He discovered that Archimedes in 250 BC had put forth a theory about buoyancy. So that was one piece of the puzzle. But Galileo was the one. Have you ever seen his thermometers that, you know, they have the glass balls in the fluid and they're floating, and so when it's at the right temperature, it's at that right level, and that the ones they float or they're sunk. Well, so when you come to this question about the weight of air, of wind, the weight of air versus the weight of water, we've had a lot of rain this week. And do you realize that if you were to take 1 cubic mile of an average storm cloud, that in that 1 cubic mile is 9.6 billion pounds? And, of course, we don't feel the weight. But there's just that. There's that much, and it's all balanced. It's just like those thermometers. It's kind of floating in there. And people say, well, how can that be? Well, the weight of dry air in that same 1 cubic mile of space would weigh 11.2 billion pounds. And so there again, the more water vapor you have, and of course, you know, when we're going to have storms, what happens to barometric pressure? It goes down. It's because there's a lot more water vapor in there, and so there's a lot less pressure on it. And that's why. So, like I say, these, on the surface, you don't realize how profound the questions are till you start getting into some of the science of it, and you realize just what really went into and how long it took man, all of mankind, to figure some of these out. Now, that's just 4 of roughly 100 questions that were asked. And so I think that, like I say, most people want to talk about the suffering of Job, and certainly there's that piece of it. But when you look at the secrets that are revealed, when you look into the nature of God and you look into the evilness and the nature of Satan, and then you look into the fact that he's actually talking about a mediator and a redeemer, you know, 1,600 years before Christ, that there's a lot in this. And that's just to say the tip of the iceberg. I think Job is one of my favorite Old Testament books. But It should give us comfort to realize that we're not the ones that are in control. God is. And if there's any way that this group can help you, if you have not made the decision or not accepted your salvation or the offer for salvation, please come forward as we sing the hymn that was asked.